Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Not many musicians cite design or architecture as their inspiration. But sitting in a beautifully designed German airport in 1978, Brian Eno was inspired to create atmospheric music to complement the space. His landmark album, Music for Airports, followed. And with it, Eno created ambient music, an entirely new genre that still thrives today. Brian Eno's 50-year career is teeming with innovation. He started out playing synths in the early 70s as a member of the UK glam rock band Roxy Music, went on to record a series of solo albums, and eventually produced career-defining albums for a host of bands, including U2, Devo, and Coldplay. His latest project is a radio station through Sonos Radio HD. He'll be streaming 300 unreleased songs from his decades in music, including some that he's still making today. The station is called The Lighthouse. And on today's episode, Rick Rubin talks to Brian Eno a bit about that station, and also about his love for the musical space that exists between humans and machines. Eno also recalls predicting the birth of hip-hop in the back of a cab with David Byrne, and explains why listening to Beyoncé playing through a wall is strangely satisfying.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Rick Rubin with Brian Eno.
I'm going to start in a funny place because just now before we start, I was thinking about a lot of things. And the last thought that came up before I made notes this morning was to ask what was the last bit of technology to come along that has influenced the way you work.
There have been a few. I've been working quite a lot with my friend Peter Chilvers, who's a musician and a coder. And we've been working on ways of manipulating MIDI automatically. And effectively what we're doing is taking a MIDI signal and subjecting it to various probabilistic mutations. So, for instance, you have a stream of information going into the MIDI, and you say, leave out 13% of that. So if you have a drum part, it sounds like the drummer is dropping a beat every so often. Or we can say things like, every 1 in 20 beats, double it, or move it by a quarter beat. So we can take parts that are fairly fixed, or what, which are loops, in fact, and we can suddenly bring them to life in some very, very interesting and uncanny ways. It doesn't really sound like what humans would do, but it doesn't sound like what machines do either. So it's an interesting new zone, I think. I've always liked those zones between the human and the mechanical. This is why I love all the voice treatments that are going on now so much, because that's always what I wanted to hear. The one thing that used to be sacred, you could never touch, was the voice. And I always thought, why not? You know, it's just another piece of electronic material like anything else. We can do what we like with it.
Do you ever feel like going the other way? Do you ever start with something that's synthetic or programmed and decide to recreate it with traditional instruments? Have you ever done that?
I've done that, and it hasn't always been very successful. In fact, it's actually rather rarely been successful for me. And I think it's because what I enjoy about the use of the electronics and the computers is that they do things that humans can't do. And I really like that area just between what we can do and what machines can do. There's this sort of new area that is appearing. I mean, people are noticing it more and more, particularly with vocals. Suddenly there are these ways of singing that you've never heard before. And what's very interesting, of course, is that a new generation of people are learning to sing like that. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those wonderful things on YouTube of where young people have clearly heard a Rihanna record or something like that and thought, oh, that's great. I'm going to sing like that. And they don't actually realize that it's done with an auto-tune.
Yes.
That it was not possible to sing like that until somebody did it with a machine. And then somebody else thought, well, it's possible, so I'll do it.
In the case of the first example where you're removing bits of MIDI information, would you say that the random aspect of the process is always at work for you?
I like things when there's a layer of surprise, I suppose. And it's not because I have this John Cageian faith in randomness. For him, it was a sort of religious feeling that randomness tied you into the synchronicity of the world, that somehow by using randomness, you allowed the state of things to affect your work. It's a nice idea, and I like it, and I respect it in his work. For me, it's a way of searching a musical space that I wouldn't do using just my taste. I mean, one's taste tends to propel you into the same areas over and over again. The interesting thing about randomness is that sometimes you're taken somewhere that you didn't expect to go. And sometimes that turns out to be a really interesting new place. So randomness for me is really just a tool, just a way of taking me somewhere different.
So it's not random for the sake of random, but through the random process, you find something new that you're looking for that you didn't know you were looking for, essentially.
That's exactly right. Yes, something happens and you kind of recognize it. You think, yes, that makes sense. The reason I think this is interesting is because I think what makes any work of art interesting is, or gripping or effective, is the feeling that somebody was living. Somebody was living it. Somebody was alert and alive and passionate in some way. And the way you get into that state is by being in unfamiliar territory, I think. You're most alive when you're not quite sure what is going on, when you're slightly flying by the seat of your pants and you have to negotiate it somehow. That's why we love improvisation so much, because people are deliberately putting themselves at risk in a way, soaring out into the unknown and somehow dealing with it. And that process of hearing someone dealing with it is the difference between life and death in a piece of work, I think. So I suppose all of the strategies and techniques that I use, and there are quite a lot of them besides randomness, are really ways of trying to find myself in a new place, because I get excited when I'm in a new place. I like being in unfamiliar surroundings. I always used to say that artists are either cowboys or farmers, really. And they're both ways of being an artist are fine. You know, the farmer wants to find a piece of territory and fully explore it and exploit it. You know, you could say the last 20 years of Mondrian was like that, when Mondrian finally settled on the style that we all know him for. He just carried on doing it. But the other kind of artist is the one who just wants to find somewhere new. He just wants to find the next frontier, the next piece of territory. And that's what he gets turned on by. So I think I'm more in the second category, though people listening to my work would say, but it all sounds exactly the same, Brian.
Do you have that same approach in life beyond art? Are you an explorer? Have you lived all over the world? Do you continue to put yourself in new situations as a human being as opposed to an artist?
I have such an amazing amount of inertia, you wouldn't believe it. I wouldn't leave my studio if I had the choice, probably. No, it's not that bad, but the only reason I ever go anywhere really is because I don't have a choice. For instance, I had to go to New York in 1978 to do something for a week. And it was a nice, lovely weather when I arrived. It was this time of year. Somebody said, well, I've got a sublet if you want to stay. And I ended up spending 5 years there just because it was a nice day when I arrived.
Yes. So
I didn't have any intention of living in New York. And then I left New York because I had to go to Tokyo to do something, and I was away in Tokyo, and somebody robbed my studio and took everything. Actually, everything was gone. And somebody rang me up and said, your whole studio's disappeared. And I suddenly had this feeling of relief. I thought, oh, I don't have to go back to New York then. So then I moved to Toronto after that for a little while. But I don't really move very much unless I have to for some reason, or unless I don't plan things very well. I'm pretty happy wherever I am, actually.
I think we have that in common. And it's funny, I'm wondering if the urge to adventure creatively is the balance for the fact that we live such hermetic lives.
I think that's a very good theory, yes. I know that whatever I'm doing in my work always seems to be balancing what is happening in the rest of my life. For instance, when I lived in New York, I lived on a very, very, very noisy corner. It was on the corner of Broome and Broadway. So Broadway, very busy street, and then Broome was the cross street where all the big trucks used to go on their way to the tunnel. I lived at the top of the building, but it used to kind of rock with this sound. And it was whilst I lived there that I made the quietest music I've ever made. And I'm sure what I was trying to do was to make the place in the music that I needed to be able to get to sometimes as a relief from living in New York. And then I moved back to England about 2 years later, 3 years later, and I moved to the countryside, to the town that I grew up in, very quiet, small country town. And then I made the loudest music I'd ever made in my life. Again, I think I needed a bit of city. I needed, you know, some grit, some noise. So, yes, I think that's kind of what artists do. They're always making worlds, and sometimes worlds that they would just like to visit and look at, sometimes worlds they would like to spend time in.
Earlier you said we're born with a particular taste. Do you feel like your current taste is the taste you were born with, and or has it evolved and changed over the course of your life?
That's a very good question. I remember when I first started painting, because painting was the first artistic thing I did. I never learned to play an instrument, so I was a painter as a kid. And I remember I loved combinations of red and blue that produced the mauve-violet range of the spectrum. And I did loads of paintings just exploring that sort of what I felt was a melancholy, deep area of color. And certainly the melancholy of it was a big part of what attracted me. And I don't think that's ever gone. I still have that feeling for, it's sort of a nostalgia for other futures that could have happened but didn't, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. How old were you at this time that you were painting?
Oh, I started when I was about 9 or 10, but I got into the purple area when I was about 13 or 14. I was very, very impressed by Mondrian from early on. I used him as an example earlier, but I loved the simplicity of his pictures because I kept thinking, how can something that is so simple, objectively, you know, how can that have such an effect on me? It was the closest thing to magic that I had ever seen. And at the same time, I loved doo-wop music. Now, you're probably a bit too young for doo-wop, aren't you?
But no, I'm a fan of doo-wop. I am too young for it, but there was a, growing up in New York, there was a radio show on the oldies station on Sundays that played 2 or 3 hours of doo-wop every weekend, Don K. Reed, and I listened to it religiously, and I absolutely love doo-wop.
Yeah, well, that had the same sort of effect on me, because doo-wop is a very simple music in many senses. You know, it's mainly about voices, not about lots of instruments and lots of playing. And in fact, the closer it was to a cappella, the more I liked it. And I just loved the fact that four voices could produce such a range of colors and feelings. That seemed to me like on a par with Mondrian, you know. And I was always very drawn to this idea of doing as much as possible with as little as possible. I was never impressed by the kind of music that used, you know, complicated time signatures and amazingly brilliant playing and so on. It's sort of impressive, but for me, there was not the same magic in that. You could see the trick being done, you know. So that part of my taste hasn't changed. I really am always drawn to things that look like anybody could do them,
yeah.
Where you think, I could have made that. But I fucking didn't. Why didn't I? I don't know if you have this feeling, but part of the feeling of, one of the feelings I always have that tells me something is great is kind of anger that I didn't do it.
I don't have that, but I understand it. I do. I'm so thankful when there's something that I like that I didn't make, because it's so exciting. It's like, wow. Often I make things more out of the need for them to exist.
Yes, that's exactly right. I want this music to exist.
Yeah. The only reason I make music, the reason I got into this line of work was because I was experiencing hip-hop music. And the records that were being made didn't reflect what it actually was.
Yes.
So my earliest work was really just documenting something that I was already a fan of, and it just didn't exist in the world. So I didn't really have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So when I do hear something that I like, I get very excited, because I'm always looking for something that feels like a new way in.
Yes. What you said there is something that I've often thought, that the things that influence me most in terms of actually making things are the things that I hear that don't quite succeed, where I listen to them and I think, that's a brilliant idea. And do you know what? If they had done this and that and this other thing and left that bit out, that would be even better. So quite often when I'm thinking like that about something, I realize that I'm inventing something new, which isn't that thing, but isn't something that I really had thought about before either. So it's quite often hearing something just missing the mark that makes me think that could be better. That's been an important thread for me.
Do you find that if you look back, the most interesting things have hit you that way? Like when you first hear something or see something, you don't know whether you like it or not. Or maybe it makes you laugh, or it seems ridiculous, or...
Yes.
But then you come around to loving it, or maybe loving it the most.
Yes, 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 absolutely. I really admired The Who. I loved My Generation and things like that. And then they released a song called Happy Jack. I thought, they shouldn't release lightweight material like this. They are a serious revolutionary radical band. What are they doing releasing this kind of material? And I even wrote to Pete Townsend saying, you shouldn't be releasing stuff like this. You're much too important, or something to that effect. And it was about 3 or 4 months later that I suddenly got it, that this was a kind of pop art. So that's one example of something where I had a real change of mind. And I've had more of those in painting than in music. In music, I kind of very often have a pretty good feeling of what is about to happen. I don't mean that I could make it, but I'm not incredibly surprised by it. For instance, I remember saying to David Byrne, we were in a car in Los Angeles in 1980, and I said, I think there is going to be a kind of music where people kind of shout poetry over beats. And indeed there was.
Yes.
It wasn't entirely an unscripted idea. I'd heard something on NPR. It was a poet, a black poet from somewhere in America, reading this poem called Cadillac. I spent years trying to find this thing. I never found it. I wrote to NPR and I phoned them up and everything. It was called Pink Cadillac. And he just did this amazing, very rhythmic poem about how he wanted a pink Cadillac and how cool it was and how it turned rounded the corner and things like that. And I thought, this is a new kind of music. I mean, I knew about The Last Poets. They were sort of in the back of my mind as well. But I just suddenly had this vision of a popular music, not a music that would only be on NPR, but a popular music that people would want to hear, that had heavy beats and speech, not songs.
Was the Pink Cadillac piece that you heard, did it have a beat or was it a cappella?
I think it was a cappella, or just had a very, I can't remember it very well now. In fact, I only heard it that once.
Yeah.
It just stuck in my mind, and I can still remember the cadence of some of it. And there may have just been a, you know, that Pink Cadillac, that kind of feeling to it, you know. And I thought, yeah, that is definitely new.
We'll be right back after a quick break with more from Brian Eno.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with more from Rick Rubin and Brian Eno.
Can you remember any other forms of music that either do or don't yet exist that you've imagined?
Yes. There's one that has just come into existence, I think. And it's something that I have been sort of playing around with. Do you know this this listening practice? I don't really know what to call it exactly. I could call it music, but I'm not sure it is the right word for it. It's called ASMR. Mm-hmm. This is where people are listening very close up to noises like this. And there's lots of smacking lips and that kind of thing. And basically, people tell quite long stories, but they're hardly stories. It's about that sound. And they often use stereo microphones so they can move their voices from one of your ears to the other and back and forth. It's very, very interesting because these are quite long pieces. And just go on YouTube and have a look. They've got millions and millions of listeners. So there's a lot of people doing this. So I heard these, first of all, I think 3 or 4 years ago, I heard the first ones and thought, this is really interesting. This is like having somebody wandering around inside your head, whispering to you. And I thought, this is kind of it's like ambient music, actually. There's a sort of diminution of content in favor of sound. So it's a kind of live, of-the-moment sound experience that doesn't really have a past or a future. You know, it's not what philosophers call teleological. It doesn't go somewhere. It doesn't have a goal. It's a steady state experience. And this, of course, is what I always wanted ambient music to be, like a picture on the wall. You don't expect it to change all the time. What changes is you, the listener. The art stays relatively still. So I heard this ASMR stuff and thought, this is a kind of ambient music. And I thought, what about making music that is vocal music, but like that? I had never really thought about ambient music being vocal before then. In fact, it was for me specifically not vocal. It was a sort of deliberately personality-free music. And putting a voice in there to me was to draw all the attention to the voice and say, oh, here's somebody with something to tell you. And I really didn't want that. But then when I heard this ASMR, I thought, this person clearly has nothing to tell me at all. They're talking about how they comb their hair and doing it for 25 minutes. Clearly, the message is not about combing hair. The message is about being inside a voice for a decent length of time. So I started to think, what would you do to existing music to make it occupy that same space? And then I started experimenting with my favorite tool of all in the studio, which is the low-pass filter. Just taking off all the high frequency of things has an amazing psychological effect to me. It creates scale, distance, warmth, and a weird sort of intimacy, which is quite strange, I think, because you know you're missing a lot of detail. Your brain very actively engages with those kinds of sounds. That's my theory about why it's interesting anyway. So I started thinking, perhaps there could be a kind of music like that where we take existing songs, you know, a Rihanna record, and we just put it through a low-pass filter, but really a really radical low-pass filter. So nothing above, say, 250 hertz is audible. If you listen to a Beyoncé record through a wall, it's not exhausting, it's warm. So about a week ago, somebody said to me, oh, have you heard this new ASMR music thing? And described exactly that same experiment. So it's like you're listening to records that are being played in another room. So you just have that sort of comforting... You can't really figure out what it is, but it's sociable somehow. It's friendly. It's like having other people around.
It's like a daydream almost.
Yes. That's a good way of saying it, yeah.
Sounds fantastic. On the other side of that, are lyrics ever important to you?
They're very rarely the thing I'm most listening to in music. Mm-hmm. I think the base requirement for me in lyrics is that they don't make the music stupid, which turns out to be quite a high bar in many cases. Now, people say doo-wop lyrics are stupid, but I don't think they are at all. They serve the music absolutely. Doo-wop lyrics are the way of making a voice become musical. What is always awkward to me is when somebody feels they have something to say and it's important, and you get these clumsy pieces of scanning and the rhymes don't sound stupid and so on. I can't bear that. I'd rather just leave out the voice completely than have that. But I mean, there are lyricists who I absolutely adore. Like I always say Joni Mitchell, who's for me one of the greatest songwriters of all time. And her lyrics are so clever and intricate and always worth returning to, that I'm always hearing new things in her singing and new interpretations of what she's saying. And there are a few people like that, very, very few, whose work I actually do really want to know the lyrics of.
Where do you think the line is between sounds and music?
It's where that line is actually one of the things I've thought about most in thinking about music. I had an accident years and years ago where I was confined to bed for a while. And one afternoon, a rainy afternoon, a friend of mine came over, and I said, as she left, I said, can you just put a record on for me? I had a record player, but it wasn't close to the bed. So she put this record on. It was a record of Welsh harp music. And she just put the needle on and she left. And it was actually very quiet, but I couldn't get up to change the volume. And the rain was beating down outside. And I suddenly had this realization that I loved the fact that the music seemed to be arising out of the rain. It wasn't on top of the rain. Sometimes it was submerged by the rain, but these notes, the loudest notes, were appearing out of the rain. And I thought, how lovely to co-opt the surroundings to become part of the music. So this was in 1974, I think, or five. So I started thinking, what about if you made a kind of music that didn't have a hard edge to it, that didn't have a hard boundary, that wasn't done so that you knew that that was a musical sound and that everything else was just random everyday noise. I thought, what about softening the edges of the music so that you include some things that could be noise outside of the music, that could be the street or the rain or the wind or something like that. So I started building in this sort of where ambient music started coming from, was this idea of making music that had a soft edge that blended into the rest of the world. So this idea of saying, let's make the edge soft so that the music can invite in more of the rest of the world. It draws it in and that becomes part of the composition as well. And I think this was at the time I was starting to think about messiness as well, that I didn't want the work to be sort of in a little capsule, tidily closed off from the rest of the world. I wanted it to feel like it was somehow connected to it, that it bled into the rest of the world.
What did you look like at the time, at that point in time? How were you dressing?
I think I still had long hair. I was still wearing makeup, I think, then. Yeah, mid-70s I was, yes. And I wore a lot of unusual clothes.
I'm just wondering, like, how the juxtapositions, you know, it's like the person who's dressed like that making the music that you don't look at or don't pay attention to. It's just, it's really interesting.
No,
really,
you're absolutely right. It's sort of inconsistent. And it became clearer to me that they were inconsistent, that my physical appearance was saying, look at me, but my musical output was saying, it's nothing. It's just a tint. It's just an atmosphere. You know, no big deal. Carry on with your life.
And maybe that was, again, the looking for the balance.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, the art was looking for the balance. And
yep, I never thought of that. That's very, very likely true. From about the late 70s on, I started to not want to be a pop star. And really, that was because I thought it was misleading people. You know, if the whole thing is about me, that's actually not a very interesting subject, to be honest. I'm not a boring person or anything like that, but I didn't think that my personality was the thing that I had to offer the world.
Yeah, you saw larger issues.
Yes, exactly. Like, what is the edge? What is the yes. edge of art?
Yes.
That was the issue that really interested me, I think. What do we call art and where do we draw the boundary? And what do we mean by art anyway? You know, for me, the most interesting question for a long, long time has been, why do we want to make art at all? And why do we want to listen to it? I mean, it's an incredibly deep question. Why do we like music? Why? You know, if you think about it, what is music? It's a kind of arrangement of noises. But, you know, we have incredibly strong feelings about them. If you said to a Martian who just landed on Earth, you played them four string quartets, you know, there's Shostakovich, there's a Brahms, there's whatever else, and then there's one done by a computer, and there's one played by a group of talentless 14-year-olds who've just got those instruments. And you said, what's the difference between those? They'd probably say, well, there's no difference. They all sound exactly the same. But we are hearing very, very, very fine distinctions between these things. We obviously care about and value these experiences in quite intense ways. And since I was about 17, I've been thinking about this question of, what are we doing it for? What are we hearing? Why does it matter? We clearly can live without music. It's not like food. We can't live without food, and we can't live without clothes, and we can't live without communicating with other human beings. And there are all sorts of things we have to do. Music isn't one of them. Painting isn't one of them. Sculpture, none of those things that we call arts are things that we have to do. So why are we doing them? And why is it so universal? We don't know of a culture that doesn't have music.
Well, then I'm not sure that we don't have to do it, if that's
well,
the
yes.
case.
Yes, of course, you're
I mean,
right.
it's not functional in terms of survival. It doesn't seem, we have never tried the experiment
yeah.
to take it away. But yeah. it seems to have some ability to allow us to feel or understand ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The music isn't what's important. It's the reaction that's important.
Yes, exactly. It's what is happening to us.
Yeah. I imagine it when we tap into that in art, it makes us also feel less alone. Not even that someone made it, but there's something out there that resonates with me, even if it's the paint.
Yes.
I'm not this thing that doesn't understand itself. Here's something that is being reflected back that resonates with me. I feel a connection. So it's like love, might be like love.
Now, I think this is such an important point that the thing that binds communities together is shared culture. And it's for exactly that reason, I think. It's the knowledge that there are a group of other people who have these same feelings. You might not even be able to articulate them, but you know, I can remember this so strongly from when I was young, that you defined yourself almost by the set of feelings that you responded to. So, for instance, I remember there was a time when you were either a Beatles fan or a Rolling Stones fan, and they were fundamentally different. They talked about a different kind of person. You know, doesn't matter that in the end they all ended up millionaires, and doesn't matter. It's not important. What was important was that they presented these two different pictures of the kinds of feelings that were appropriate to have about the world. And crossing over from one to the other was a big decision. I can remember people having real sort of identity crises about, they were starting to find the Stones more exciting than the Beatles. And in fact, they were starting to find the Beatles a bit sort of wimpy. Or vice versa, actually, as well. It happened both ways. So I think you're right that you tap into a sort of community of feelings, and the sense that there are other people who value the same feelings that I value. That's sort of what it's about, really. It's about saying, these feelings have value for me, and there's a lot of others that don't.
Yeah, there's also a great feeling in finding a new piece of art and sharing it with someone, and enjoying it together is different than enjoying it yourself. There's a real sense of community in enjoying something that, you know, we enjoy this, but maybe many people don't, and that's fine.
Yes.
It's a great feeling of connection. And maybe that's the greatest feeling of connection, is the feeling of these shared responses to stimuli.
Yes, and incidentally, I think that's the power of religion as well. The power of religion is not the connection with God, but the connection with the rest of the congregation, I think. The connection with all of the people who also believe in that particular story. I'm not really religious myself, but I really respond to that idea. You know, I got into gospel music very young. In fact, when I came to America, I was by then a big gospel fan. And what surprised me was that all my hip friends thought it was quite embarrassing. they found it a little bit quaint or something that I liked gospel music. To me, it was just like doo-wop had been. It was this amazing, exotic, foreign music. And it really came straight through to me.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more from Brian Eno.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboar'snest. We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin's conversation with Brian Eno.
I've heard the story before of the moment of recognition, or the need for what became ambient music based on the Cologne airport.
Yes.
Sitting in the Cologne airport. How might it have been different if it would have happened in a natural space as opposed to a man-made space?
Well, the question really is, would it have even occurred to me if I was in a natural space? I'm not sure that it would have done. It was because I was in an incredibly carefully manufactured space, beautiful airport, where the architects had really looked at every detail, and the light was beautiful and the lines of the place were beautiful. And somebody in the cafe had put on a cassette of German disco music, which was ringing through the airport. I mean, I wasn't postmodern enough at the time to accept that. I just thought, that's not right. That part hasn't been thought about. Everything else has been thought about, but nobody's thought about that. Now, it was a beautiful day and the airport was nearly empty, and I was sitting there bathed in light. And it was one of those cases like we were talking about earlier, where you think, I wish there was another kind of music for this situation. And I started thinking, so what would that be like? You know, it's an airport, so you can't be too loud. Obviously, people have to hear announcements. It has to be interruptible for the same reason. It shouldn't dominate the vocal register because people need to communicate. So I just was sort of thinking this out, and quite soon I thought, right, I think I know what I could make that music. I know how I could do that. And that's how that first ambient record came about. I mean, it wasn't unprecedented. I had been working on music a little bit like that before, but I suddenly realized what its role in life could be, if you like, what the place of this music could be. I knew it wasn't dance music. I knew it wasn't radio music. It was functional, but I hadn't yet discovered the function. It was then that I thought, I know what this music could be for.
Might there be other forms of ambient music for different use cases?
Yes, I did a record called Nerily. The subtitle was Music for Thinking. That really came out of a response, well, first of all, hearing from a lot of particularly artists and graphic designers that they liked having my music playing when they were working. They didn't want conventional records, which kept stopping and starting and the mood changing, and there was lyrics and they were kind of annoying. They didn't want classical music because it sort of felt too old. They liked this music that had this sort of directionless, atmospheric quality. So I thought, oh, good. So it's working. It's working functionally. And so I thought, so what about when you want to sit and concentrate on something? You want to have something that kind of calms the world down a little bit around you, that softens, as Eric Satie said, softens the clink of fork against dinner plate or something like that. I forget the quote exactly. But you want something that is sort of a slight barrier to the noises of the world, and it becomes a barrier by sucking them into itself. And so then I came up with this piece called Nerily, which is an hour-long piece, which at the time was the longest I could make it. And I started thinking then about the idea of music that doesn't have a beginning or end, that just is theoretically infinite. Well, that didn't become possible until the 90s when I started working with computers, and it was possible to make the kinds of programs I make now where the music effectively never repeats. And my ambition always then was to try to make an experience a little bit like sitting by a river. So you're sitting by the river. It's always the same river, but as you know, it's never the same river twice. So every time you look up at the river, it's doing something a little bit different. Now, it's not like watching a film where suddenly the river turns blood red or gets much bigger or something like that. I didn't want drama. I just wanted something like nature.
Subtle variations.
Subtle variations. Yes, and variations that stay within a kind of range of possibilities and explore that range rather randomly. I just wanted the thing to be what Harold Budd used to call eternally pretty. That was his way of saying it. Dear Harold, he died about 2 months ago from COVID. Very sad. So I dedicate this thought to Harold. So yes, so when Harold and I met, we were both pretty much on this groove of thinking, what about making music that isn't designed to upset anybody? Now, of course, that sounds pretty uncontroversial now, but in the mid to late 70s, that was considered to be the biggest sellout of all time. You know, music was supposed to shake the world and create revolutions and upset your parents and all sorts of things like that. And we thought, what about making music that is just really comfortable? Comfortable was probably the most controversial word you could use then. What about music that makes you feel warm and friendly and open and able to surrender? When I realized that surrender was really the thing that I was interested in for that kind of music, obviously I don't only make that kind of music, but for that, I wanted to make something that would make you think, I can let something happen to me. I don't have to defend against everything. I can get out of that posture of self-defense. If you think of the things that where we achieve transcendence, if you like, or ecstasy, it's sex, drugs, art, and religion. Those are all the places where we say, I'm going to let go and just let this thing happen to me. I'm not going to control it. I'm going to be taken somewhere. Now, it's interesting to me that although we are constantly trying to control, our biggest thrills come from letting go of control. And so what becomes obvious is that it's the combination of those two that we should really be specializing in. We should not forget the surrender part. We should not think that surrendering is passivity or cowardice or incompetence. We should say it's one of the ways we deal with the world. So I think art is the place where we go to have this feeling again, to remember that feeling of going with the flow, of letting something happen to us. In real life, in the rest of life, I should say, we're still able to do that. We can remember that feeling.
For me, there's certain, I can see a film that has an energy in it that could affect me for months.
Yes.
And I'm very open to the energies contained in things. So I'm mm-hmm. protective of what I watch for that reason. I don't want to have a bad time a lot of the time. I don't choose that. I just want to ask how sensitive you are in that respect.
I think I'm very sensitive in that respect. And to the extent that certain experiences, I don't want to have them very often because I don't want them to lose their power.
Yeah.
So just about the single album that probably influenced me more than almost any other was the Third Velvet Underground album. That was a really, really important record in my life because so many things I had been wondering if they were possible suddenly appeared on that album, and also a lot of things I hadn't even conceived of. For that reason, I've never owned the album. I haven't even listened to it that many times because I really wanted it to retain that power. I didn't want it to become commonplace.
Yes.
Another piece like that is the Steve Reich piece, It's Gonna Rain, that tape piece from, I think, 1964. That absolutely devastated me the first time I heard it. I understood so many things about music that I had not even dreamed of before that piece. And I still regard it as a key moment in my life. And I think I've probably listened to it 4 times. It turned a switch and the switch stayed turned.
Yes.
I didn't have to keep turning it again, you know. It stayed turned.
In your evolution up to ambient music, it's fascinating to me that you could ever do anything different than that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, it almost feels like that's the end of the line. In terms of the minimalist approach, you got there. So it's interesting that you do other things. Like, you didn't do the Mondrian staying in the same language only.
Yes, perhaps if I had carried on living in New York, I would have done.
Maybe.
Because I would have always wanted more of that kind of music. But I've just had the very interesting experience of, do you know about this Sonos project that I'm doing?
I don't really. Tell me.
Okay, well, Sonos asked me to curate a channel for them, basically. It's like my own radio station. And I like the idea of that. But I thought what I'd really like to do is to curate a station that plays only my music. Because I've got so much unreleased stuff. You know, I work in the studio every day, pretty much, and some of it is just experiments where I try something out just to see what it would do if you tried to make a piece of music like that. And I have thousands of recordings like that. I just mix everything. You know, when I finish the day, I mix whatever I've done that day. Sometimes it can be 5 or 6 different pieces even. So I have this vast library of stuff. Some of it is really quite interesting. And I thought, how nice would it be to have a radio channel where you just switch it on and out come pieces of music that you've never heard before, will probably never hear again, and they're all quite different from one another. There's quite a range of stuff. Some of it is very ambient, some of it is very hard beat stuff, some of it's really electronic, some of it is touchingly human, which is how you describe something that is rather amateurish. So for the first time in my life, I thought, well, I'll just start listening through to those things. And so they play on random shuffle out of my computer. And I have to say, I so like the collisions, the strange combinations of things. You know, something from 1991 next to something I did last year, next to something from 2005, and no rationale to the choices, that they're randomly selected. And although some of the music is pretty challenging, a lot of it is quite easy to listen to. And as I would say to people, you'll probably only hear it once. So if you don't like it, just wait. Something else will come along soon.
Yeah. I have one last question to ask, just because I'm really curious. What's your relationship to spirituality?
Well, as you can tell from the way I talk too much, I think about this kind of thing quite a lot. What I always want to do is to cut away as much of the shit as possible and see what's left. So I don't want to be a believer. I want to be somebody who, as far as possible, understands and knows things. Believing things leaves me a little bit unsatisfied. If I find myself believing something, I want to test the belief. I want to say, how do I find out how valid this is, how true this is? Now, in real belief, in proper faith, you're not supposed to do that. Faith is supposed to be the, by definition, the acceptance of something that you cannot find evidence for. If you can find evidence for it, it's not faith anymore. It's called knowledge then. So this is a long way round of saying that I'm not anti-spiritual. I'm not anti-religion, actually. In fact, I can see how religion really cements some communities together and really helps people in their lives. But I'm not by nature a believer. So it's difficult for me to use that kind of cement. My cement has to come from trying to understand things and to see how they work and to share those ideas with other people.
Yeah.
So I think one of the other things that surrendering prepares you for is the experience of uncertainty, the experience of not knowing the answer, but still having to do something, you know. The fact that you don't know the answer can't cripple you. And of course, a lot of people are crippled by not knowing the answer. And so they just choose an inappropriate answer just for the want of an answer.
Yes.
So you just have to accept that you don't know the answers and you will make mistakes and you will need to change your values and your tools. And some of them might last you a lifetime, but you're lucky if that happens. I haven't got any that lasted me a lifetime.
Thank you so much for doing this. Amazing. A pleasure speaking with you.
Yes, you too. I must say, I really enjoyed that.
Thanks to Brian Eno for sharing his artistic philosophy with us. To hear our favorite Brian Eno tracks, head to BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez. With engineering help from Nick Chafee, our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Hey, it's Justin Richmond. I want to talk to you about another podcast called Comedy Bang Bang. If you haven't heard of Comedy Bang Bang, it's one of the longest-running comedy podcasts out there and has truly revolutionized the medium. Every episode, host Scott Aukerman interviews a famous guest like Andy Samberg and Jon Hamm. But unlike every normal interview show, Scott and the guest are joined by a group of unhinged fictional characters played by the best comedic improvisers around. People like Nick Kroll, Lauren Lapkus, Paul F. Tompkins, and Ben Schwartz. Over the years, the podcast has built an expanded universe with tons of recurring jokes and fan-favorite characters. But the best part is you can still easily jump in at any time and enjoy a new episode as a first-time listener. So check out new episodes of Comedy Bang Bang every Monday, wherever you listen to your podcast.